This episode is sponsored in part by the Pastor Theologians Conference. Each October, the Center for Pastor Theologians hosts a one-of-a-kind interdenominational gathering of pastors and ministry leaders from across the U.S., exploring some of the most pressing issues facing the church in today's complex world. This year's conference is called Good Shepherds: Pastoral Identity and the Future of the Church. In our contemporary context, the pastorate can often be shaped by visions of leadership that sometimes overemphasize method and technique. We can find this, of course, in church growth strategies, in business-based leadership models, and in social media influencer culture. It's easy when navigating all the details to lose the plot, but October 20th to 22nd, you're invited to Chicago to renew your vision and commitment to following the way of the Good Shepherd. The Good Shepherds Conference will bring together a diverse group of pastors and ministry leaders to reflect together on how we can model pastoral ministry as under-shepherds of Jesus of Nazareth. Speakers include Kate Sonderegger, Matt O'Reilly, Doug Sweeney, Amy Peeler, and many more. Learn more and register at cptconference.com. That's cptconference.com.
All of us are looking for some sort of sense of enoughness and contentment. And it's staring at us right there on the cross and in the empty tomb. And none of us need to do anything else to be made right in the world. That's, in this day and age, a message that is so counter to what the powers and the principalities of our time would have to say.
The Living Church, serving the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion since 1878. Welcome to the Living Church Podcast. Welcome back, podcast listeners. Overwhelm. Have you heard this word? Have you used this word lately? This is a word that I've been hearing a lot, overwhelm, in politics and national life, in personal life and relationships, in ministry. It is so evocative. It's just so accurate. And what a word for our times. Part of the reason this word is so apt, I think, is that we live in an age of what our guest today calls polycrisis. Issues are so interconnected. They pile on top of one another and seem to come hard and fast these days, faster than we can fix or it feels like respond to in a thoughtful Christian way. Overwhelm. But take a breath. Slow down that heart rate, because as we know, neither inaction nor anxiousness make for the good life and probably aren't what you want to characterize your ministry either. So today we'll do a bit of naming. What is polycrisis? What does it involve? What are the common threads in the systems that place pressure on communities and human life? And then we'll seek what our guest today calls apocalyptic clarity. As a former Pentecostal, I love that phrase. And ask, how do we recognize what's true despite appearances? How do we resist what's false in Jesus' name and participate joyfully in what God is doing? Turns out apocalyptic clarity is a pretty helpful window to both perspective and practical decision-making in a 21st century life. And speaking of apocalypse, it won't be long before the book of Revelation is in the preaching lectionary, so make the most of this episode, y'all. Our guest today is the Reverend Dr. Jesse Zink, principal of Montreal Diocesan Theological College. He's also the canon theologian in the Diocese of Montreal. We'll be discussing his latest book, Faithful, Hopeful, Creative, 15 Theses for Christian Witness in a Crisis-Shaped World. He's also written four previous books about Christian history and global Christianity. He's also written an introduction to theology and mission in the Episcopal Church called A Faith for the Future. And in the show notes today, I will provide a link to a downloadable discussion guide that he's made available for the book that we'll be talking about today. Now, from calling out mammon to dwelling in awe and wonder to baseball stadiums and embracing satisfaction, we hope you enjoy the conversation. Jesse, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, just can I ask you really quick how you ended up in Quebec? Because you're someone who's, you've served in Quebec and Montreal for some time, and you're in the Anglican Church of Canada, but you grew up an Episcopalian. So what was the move that took you to one of the most beautiful cities in the world. How did that happen?
Absolutely. And thank you for beginning that way about the wonderful city of Montreal, which really comes into its own, I want to say and underscore, in the winter. I'm a binational child with a Canadian mother and an American father. So I was born in Canada, but grew up in the US. So on one side of the border, I was Anglican. And on the other side, I was Episcopalian, and have had the opportunity to live in other parts of the world as well. So worked in South Africa, worked in the Church of England as well for a couple of years. And then we were looking for the opportunity to be a bit closer to family. And this position became available in Montreal. And it's proved to be, as you say, a very congenial place to live and to work and to be in ministry.
You know, Jesse, half American, half Canadian, how did you grow up with such profound confusion in your life?
I actually don't identify as half Canadian and half American, but as fully Canadian and fully American.
I'm sorry, hypostatic union of,
yes,
wow.
Thank you. Wow. You know, I really struggled to find that language until I took patristics.
Mm. Jesse, we can just end the conversation here and now. This has been beautiful.
Thank you.
Well, I'd love to talk to you about this new book that you wrote. I had no idea what to expect when the publisher sent it to me. Well, I had a little idea of what to expect because they sent me some specs on it and sent me a summary. And I think I read it in a day and a half, partly because I needed to read it quickly for work, but it was really easy to get through and full of so much. And I really do hope that people pick it up and read it. How did you come to write a book like this, or come to think this book is needed right now? Was there an inciting incident in your own life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that I write books when I feel like something needs to be said in the church that's not being said other places. I'm quite okay if somebody else says it. I want the ideas out there. And what I feel like I really want us to be thinking about in the church, and to be naming openly, as we do in the church already, I think, but I wanted to bring this to new prominence, is we live at a challenging time, right? I use the phrase crisis-shaped world. So migration or climate, opioid, mental health, race and racism, housing and homelessness, right?
Yeah.
So the word crisis is in the air. And I learned of this word polycrisis, which is a word that, as the name suggests, simply means many crises at once. And the thing about a polycrisis is that the crises are interrelated with one another, right? So we can see how climate change, for instance, leads to increased migration, to take one, you know, very obvious example. And so it becomes hard then to think about any one issue in isolation. And I wanted us to, as a church, I think we need to talk about this. Again, I'm not saying, you know, nobody's doing this, but I wanted to draw together a lot of threads into one place. And I wanted to ask the question, what does the good news of Jesus Christ look like in this particular context? I think the other thing that I wanted to do was to write something that was accessible. And so I'm pleased to hear you were able to read it relatively quickly, because I do want this to be accessible to people in pews for congregational studies, because I do think lots of people in the pews are reading the news and are wondering, what does our faith have to say to this moment? I deliberately went for breadth in this book rather than depth. Some of these theses could have been whole books on their own, and maybe someday they will be. But I wanted to introduce a range of issues, and I wanted to do so in an accessible fashion. And so that's really how this book came to be.
Thank you for writing it. And I do think that the 15 different theses, each one having a chapter, really lends itself to, as you mentioned, a study at a church or with a small group. So right out of the gate, Jesse, we're talking about polycrisis. How do you think framing this as polycrisis helps to actually address the sense of helplessness and anxiety rather than add to it? You know, polycrisis, it's not just a crisis, it's a polycrisis. Well, we know that. So I think that you have an intention that this word and the way you're framing this book, even, you're wanting to help people deal with the sense of overwhelm. Can you say a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really great question. So I think two caveats I would say right at the front is, first of all, if you study Christian history, or if you study history at all, you will know that at many previous points in human history, people have felt like the world is falling apart. You know, this is the last generation that will ever live. So I'm not making any claims that say this moment is you know, worse than any other moment in human history. I'm simply saying this is the moment that we live in which we are privileged to share the good news of Jesus Christ. So that's the first caveat. And I think the second caveat is we should have some caution around the language of crisis, particularly because I think there are ways in which the language of crisis can be loaded with privilege as well, right? So, for instance, we talk about an opioid crisis right now, but back in the 1980s and 1990s, we talked about a crack epidemic, right? And by and large, the opioid crisis has tended to affect white people, and crack tended to affect African-American people. And so we frame those differently, and that had hugely disparate impacts on how we've responded to them. And so in a sense, the crisis framing might in some ways be a function of my societal privilege. So that's a caveat. But why talk about polycrisis? Well, first of all, polycrisis is the beginning of the book, but it's not the end of the book, right? And I do think naming reality is a great way to begin. I've been surprised when I've spoken to people about this book, just the kind of sense of relief that people feel, which is like, well, gosh, my Christian faith might have something to say to all these headlines that I'm seeing that seem so overwhelming. And so where I go from right at the start of the book is from describing polycrisis and into what I call apocalyptic clarity.
And yes, I hoped you were going to say something about that, because you use apocalyptic literature to say, you know, this is also a genre that Christians have used for thousands of years, and then Jews before that, and probably, in fact, humans have just used apocalyptic literature as a way to say there's a crisis and something else is cracking through. So yeah, please.
Yeah. So when I talk about apocalyptic clarity in this book, and as you say, there's a long tradition of apocalyptic literature, both in the Jewish tradition, and then Christians, you know, adopted that. Jesus himself was quite clear that there were powers and principalities that stood in the way of the realization of his kingdom. Apocalyptic clarity calls us to see clearly the structures of our society that stand in the way of Christian witness, of Christian proclamation, of the reign of God that Jesus proclaimed and enacted. And I think part of the reason apocalypticism has been so persuasive or compelling to people in the past is precisely because by giving a vision of how things truly are, and of giving a vision of how God is acting and will continue to act in the world, it actually leads to hope, right? Apocalyptic literature is a literature of hope. And if we are called to recognize the powers that exist in the world as Christians, the apocalyptically inclined response is not necessarily to rise up in revolution. It's certainly not to give up in a sense of defeat. It's called to live communally as a community that resists the powers of this world. And so resistance then becomes an important theme in this book, that we start with this polycrisis, but we understand where it comes from and how the structures of our times are creating that crisis. And then we are called as Christians to live, use the words from the title, faithfully, creatively, hopefully, as communities rooted in the gospel that resist the powers of this world. I think what I want to underscore is that I am late to the apocalyptic party, so to speak, right? Because I am, because of my skin color and my education and my able body and all sorts of other aspects of myself, I come from a position of societal privilege. And apocalyptic literature was not written for people like me initially, but there's certainly lots of other people who have found it meaningful, including, for instance, indigenous people. Many indigenous people will say, look, like we've been living an apocalyptic existence since 1492 on this continent. And I try to build on some of that in this book and say, well, perhaps now that many of us who come from positions of privilege are finding ourselves, you know, pushed as well by these forces, hey, maybe now we can finally wake up and listen to what people have been saying all along.
Yeah, yeah. And it puts us in a position together. I mean, I love that you said coming to the party, because it puts us in a position together to see what God is going to do and to participate in it. You know, no one is ultimately left out, but for some of us, it has taken longer to come to even want this kind of good news and to seek this kind of hope that comes through an apocalyptic viewpoint. Okay, you talk about the principalities and powers. Let's talk about them. You say in your book something very bold that I would love to talk about. You say economic structures are the greatest obstacle to Christian witness. So you just name economic structures around the globe, which sort of were imported from the global north and west, that these economic structures that are in place now are currently the greatest obstacle to Christian witness. So I'd love to talk more about what you mean by this as part of this apocalyptic viewpoint. And I would also love for you to answer the person who would say, Jesse, I don't get why you'd say that. The gospel is preached every day. Christians are living good, generous, if imperfect, lives everywhere. How can worldly structures impede the gospel of the Lord? That's not possible. Are you saying we've got to take down McDonald's and Walmart before the gospel of Jesus Christ can be effective? Aren't you giving enough credit to God? Come on. You know, so I don't entirely disagree with that person. So I want to know how you would answer them and how you would tease this out.
So let me begin by saying this. As I understand the Christian gospel, it is about a message that is preached, but it's also about a kind and a quality of life. And we receive that kind and quality of life by living with other people, right? Jesus called it abundant life. Elsewhere in scriptures, it's called shalom, you know, which we translate as peace, but is really more like wholeness or completeness of life. Jesus talked about the kingdom or the reign of God. So really what the gospel is about a kind of communal life together, as I understand it, of transformed people, transformed by the love of God, to live together in this body of Christ, in this kingdom. And the role of the church now is to offer a foretaste of what God is one day finally going to do. So I think very strongly on a horizon of God's action, to use a theological word, on an eschatological horizon. There is a kingdom, and our job as Christians now in our communities and our life together is to offer a foretaste of what that kingdom will one day look like. And as I've already said, you know, the apocalyptic perspective helps us understand that there are powers in this world that will obstruct that kingdom, will obstruct that quality of life. And that's not to say that they prevent it from happening, right? You and I can tell stories of the ways in which we know that quality of life. And isn't that wonderful, right? You know, I give thanks to God. So it's not like that means the gospel is prevented from being present in the world. But apocalyptic clarity would have us say, well, what are the structures that are obstructing that? And when I look at the world, I think about our economic structures. So let's just take a couple of examples. You know, I'm influenced a lot by Michael Sandel, who's a philosopher who teaches at Harvard, who's talked about how we've moved in recent generations from having a market economy. Market economy is a valuable tool for exchanging goods and services, to being a market society. The values of the market have come to infiltrate and be part of more and more aspects of our lives. The only value that really matters in the market is price. As long as there's a willing buyer and a willing seller, you can buy and sell anything. But as Christians, we want to talk about other values beyond price, values like charity or faithfulness or trust and so on and so forth.
Could you give an example, one of the examples from your book?
Sure.
I think they're quite powerful.
Yeah, so there's just loads of examples to pick from. But, you know, one example, when I was growing up as a child on long drives with my father, we used to pass the time thinking and naming sports stadiums for various sports teams. This is how you pass the time on long drives. And one name that was always really important to me was the Sky Dome. The Sky Dome opened in 1989, and I went to the Sky Dome in 1989 to see my favorite baseball team, the Blue Jays, play in Toronto. And part of what made it so wonderful was the name, like Sky Dome. Here was this stadium with this retractable roof, which didn't quite work properly all the time, but still it was amazing, right? And, you know, I think about Pittsburgh Pirates, who used to play in Three Rivers Stadium, right? Which is a name that reflects how the natural world has shaped Pittsburgh. Well, the Sky Dome doesn't exist anymore. It's named the Rogers Center, right? And why is it named the Rogers Center? It's because a telecommunications company paid a lot of money to do that. Three Rivers Stadium doesn't exist anymore. I think it's called PNC Park. It's a company that paid the money. And that's an example of the way in which the values of the market have come to displace something. Now, you might think that's a pretty small bore thing, like, you know, my dad and I can talk about something else in the car, I guess. But it's an example of the way in which the market is coming to enter more and more areas of our life. Another example is waiting in line at the airport, right? Or waiting in line for anything. Used to be everybody more or less waited in the same security line. Now, when I go to the airport, I'm like, gosh, there's about a half a dozen lines here. Which one have I paid to go in? The Nexus line and the TSA pre-check and the like really, really important people one, and then the like unwashed masses one. And so we've said, there's no value that comes from everybody standing in line together and maybe negotiating like, oh, hey, I got a flight that's leaving soon. Do you mind if I just cut ahead? No, it's like, you got to pay to get in the line that you can afford. And that's an example of the way in which price, the market dynamics have come to affect more and more of our lives.
Can I just add to another example of this that, again, may sound like not a big deal, but is another sign of the pervasiveness of this and of the values that it carries with it. I took a last minute trip to New York for a weekend just for fun, girls' weekend last year. And because I was buying a flight last minute, I thought, ugh, okay, I'll fly Spirit Air. I have a friend who nicknamed it Evil Spirit Air because it's just so unpredictable. Spirit Air is kind of a disaster. So I was like, all right, we'll endure it. We'll fly Spirit Air. Jesse, Spirit Air is in an entirely different terminal. So these are the cheap tickets, okay? People who cannot afford, like I couldn't at that moment, to buy something on a even slightly more luxurious, i.e. actually has the flights they say they will relatively on time experience. We are shuttled through various apocalyptic looking hallways with like flickering fluorescent lights. And everything looks like, you know, it's like a scene and set design from The Fifth Element. And it's an entirely different terminal. You know, the other terminals are like A, B, C, D. This is like terminal X. And we get in there and it is sort of like a free-for-all of not being sure who to ask for directions. The signage isn't clear. There's not enough places for people to sit. So people are milling and standing. It's incredibly packed and uncomfortable and doesn't have the kinds of shops and coffee and food options that the other terminals have. And it felt like we were being packed into little groups like sheep. And then when we weren't standing in the right place because we were confused, we were yelled at to move somewhere else. And I noticed the people around me, probably a lot of them make less than I do. And I'm having to do this, you know, because I decided to take a last minute girls trip to New York, not because I have to buy Spirit Air tickets. So just another example of this kind of principle that isn't just, oh, shoot, you know, I lost the sweet name of my beloved Sky Dome. Oh, no, no. These are values that are clearly saying something about what certain people deserve and what certain other people do not deserve.
And as you just said, you know, these are somewhat humorous examples. You think, oh, is that really a big deal? But the thing of it is that as market dynamics come to penetrate more and more aspects of our lives, it puts more and more things beyond the reach of people, right? So housing is perhaps, you know, perhaps the hallmark example right here. Yes, housing has always been subject to a market economy, like a buying and selling of a house. But what we've done is we've now turned housing into an investable asset. So there are more and more, you know, investors who buy it, which means prices go up, and prices are going up for lots of reasons. But it's housing is no longer some sort of expectation. It's, well, if you can't afford to pay it, then on some level, perhaps we never quite come out and say this, this must be your own fault somehow. But we're all realizing now, in the midst of a housing crisis, how these pressures are affecting more and more people who previously maybe weren't affected by this. And what Michael Sandel, this philosopher at Harvard, says is that when the market comes to touch something, it changes how we look at it. And after you read my book, I really love for people in the church to read Michael Sandel's book from about a dozen years ago called What Money Can't Buy, The Moral Limits of Markets. And that drives a lot of my reflection in the first part of this book. So just to give credit where credit's due, you know, just to run through a couple of other examples, you know, we live at a time in which we talk about the attention economy, where one of the goods that companies want from us is our attention. And that's why we have social media apps and phones that are structured in such a way to keep as much of our attention as possible. And you might think this is a good thing, right? We live at a time of crises. We need to pay more attention to them. But in fact, what the attention economy does is it fractures our attention, it divides us, it distracts us, it leads to what Pope Francis has called the globalization of indifference. One of the things that I write about in this book is the changing labor practices, right? That we have a set of labor practices in our economy that are shredding people's times and predictability around schedules, right? We have these algorithmically designed work schedules where people don't receive their work schedule maybe until the day before. There's no predictability from week to week on which days they're going to work. I mean, Christian witness, Christian ministry depends fundamentally on being able to gather the same group of people together at roughly the same time in the same place. And yet so much of our labor practices are shredding precisely the possibility of that. So these are just a couple of the examples. And what I'm saying is that these present an obstacle to Christian witness. And I want to be clear, I'm not the only person who's said this. Pope Francis, as I say, has made this a consistent theme of his time as Pope. Justin Welby, when he was Archbishop of Canterbury, wrote a book about this. People like James K.A. Smith, the philosopher, theologian, Catherine Tanner, Harvey Cox, they've all written about this. And all I'm trying to say is that economic structures are forming and also deforming us as peoples and as communities such that it works against the ability of the Christian community to offer that foretaste, to offer that witness of the fullness of life and the coming kingdom that Jesus proclaimed and which God is working to bring about.
Hey, everybody, I'd love to tell you about our next Living Church conference that you don't want to miss. It's in St. Louis in November, and it's called Awe and Presence, a conference on worship and the arts. What do worship, going to church, or the beauty of the Christian liturgy have to do with real life? You can explore with us through art, literature, music, and history how sacraments and sacred rhythms usher us into the awe and presence of the one who is good, true, and beautiful, and forms our lives to his. Speakers include Malcolm Geit, W. David O. Taylor, Abram Van Engen, Grace Hammond, and Matthew Ulver on poetry, prayer, the body in worship, what it means to worship with the church of the past, and understanding the story we're in. Go to livingchurch.org/events for more info and to register, or click the link in the show notes today. And if you register now, you can get a 15% off early bird special. That's livingchurch.org/events. Or click the link in the show notes. And as you're talking, Jesse, I'm also thinking of Acts 2 and those four basic, they're such strong examples that they're almost mandates in, you know, the first Christian community after they received the Holy Spirit. They continued in the apostles' teaching, fellowship, breaking of bread, and prayers. And in your book, you talk about attention. And that is, it's very difficult to pray when your attention is being, you know, purchased away. The breaking of the bread, bread itself. You talk in your book about some of the difficulties in the way that we get food and the way that we receive food and share or are not able to really share food and the labor that that food comes from. Fellowship, relationships, how they become commodified, how even a road trip, you know, a bank gets to decide how your road trip looks a little different with your dad. And the apostles' teaching, being able to either even gather to remember, hear, reorient around what the apostles taught in personal relationship with our Lord and experience that relationship ourselves in community. Gathering is hard when you don't know when you're going to get scheduled any particular week. So the interrupting of just these basic structures of human life into which our Lord was wise enough to give these gifts of teaching, fellowship, breaking bread, and prayers to form us.
And let me just add on Acts 2, since you brought it up. One of my favorite passages from Acts 2 is awe and wonder came upon them. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea that the Christian community is called to dwell in wonder and to dwell in awe. And I think sometimes in a crisis-shaped world, that's what we're missing. And I think part of the reason we're missing it is because the market strips so much of that away. The market says, look, it's just about transactions. It's just about price. You all go do your own way. You do you. You do your own thing. But we lose that collective sense of wonder and awe. And I think that's part of what we're called in our communities to reclaim and hold on to at this time.
So let's take a turn toward modes and acts of resistance. The word enough is an important word in your book. The god Mammon always asks that we want more, we get more, we produce more in spite of not being able to really share well-being the way that God intends us to. And you say that Christian communities need to discover themselves anew as places of satisfaction and contentment. I'm curious about this, what this could look like. I love this. You say those weary with the struggle to survive can find rest and refreshment in the church. The church should be a place where people who are weary with the struggle to survive, the struggle for and against mammon, right? can find rest and refreshment. I'd love to talk about that. What could that look like?
Well, I just want to underscore what you just said, which is that part of the structures that we live in is this constant pressure for more, right? And that's an economic drive, but I think all of us are in some measure infected by it, right? It is so hard sometimes just to rest because we feel like, oh, we need to have more consumption, more social media interactions, more experiences. You know, we talk about FOMO, the fear of missing out. And I think that's just overwhelming for us, right? As human beings, leave aside creation and the natural limits that creation imposes on us as a human society. But us as human beings, we have limits and we need rest. This is why the Sabbath is such an important part of the Christian tradition. And yet what our economy is constantly putting out of reach is contentment and satisfaction. You know, and this book will reveal my love of etymology and words, but the word satisfaction simply means to do enough. That's what satis is, to do enough. You know, and you've mentioned mammon and Jesus talks about mammon, and I think that's important. Where I was drawn in this book is to the story Jesus tells in Luke 12 about the landowner who builds a larger storage facility and then dies before it can be filled. And he says, basically, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. And the word for greed, the Greek word there is pleonexia, which literally means an appetite for more. And another time that pleonexia appears in scriptures in the book of Colossians, when it's on the list of idolatry, it says very clearly, pleonexia, the appetite for more, greed is idolatry. Hmm. And why would Jesus be warning us against this? Because I think we're just not set up to constantly be looking for more, whether that's more stuff for ourselves, more natural resources from a limited creation. And I think contentment and satisfaction are a lot closer to gospel truth. And I really want us to remember that the gospel is not just a word of exhortation, you know, get out there in the world. The gospel is also a word of consolation. Mm. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. The Christian community is a place where we shouldn't have to do more to prove that we belong. But we need a pretty robust set of spiritual practices to make this happen. And what I would add is that, you know, at a time when the church itself is under a lot of pressure and there's a lot of change, the church doesn't always succeed at this, right? The church doesn't always succeed at being a place of contentment. Sometimes the church itself says, we need to do more. Mm. And there's a balance here, right? Yes, of course, we need to do more. But if we're constantly talking about what we need to do and how we need to do more, then I don't think we're offering a message that is really good, and when we're thinking about good news, to people who are living in the kind of economy that we're living in. So what does it actually look like? I do think it matters how we talk to and communicate with people. We need to pay attention to our rhetoric, as if our rhetoric in church is such that the success of this place depends on what we do, then I think perhaps we've kind of missed the boat. Because the church, as I say, can pretty easily succumb to the temptation for more around us. But really, I think part of the ministerial challenge, part of the resistance challenge right now, is finding ways to sustain community outside of a never-ending stream of events and programs, outside of building management and ownership, perhaps. How can we think creatively as the church goes through a process in which we are shedding some of the property that we own? How can we think creatively about how we sustain the integrity of our communities outside of owning a building or having a very active program year for our people? What kind of practices do we need to get there?
And I wonder, Jesse, what teaching could be done and what discovery by priests and bishops and ministers themselves could be done around shaping people's expectations of church. What is enough to get out of church? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you have folks that come a few times a year and that don't have those high expectations. And I would venture to guess those aren't your most difficult parishioners. That the ones who have the higher expectations are ones who have the ability to be most disappointed or most frustrated or most frustrating. I wonder how pastors shape their own expectations, you know, of what they should be putting into and receiving from their own vocations in these particular places. And also from people, you know, their own flocks. What should you expect from church? What can you just really not expect this community to give you? Or maybe probably won't give you most of the time, like any relationship, I suppose. Have you done any work with that thought?
Well, I want to say one practice that helps me in my ministry is that I write sermons and then I sort of audit them. And I say, is this a sermon that's primarily a sermon of exhortation or a sermon of consolation? And I think both have their place in the church and both have their place in the pulpit. But I do think that there are a lot of people who are coming to church who are pretty weary. I know that I come to church feeling weary. And there are people who aren't coming to church because they feel so overwhelmed. And I want to be clear that that's okay. You can come to church and not do anything, and that is enough. And that I want the words that they hear from me when I preach to be words of consolation that say, you who are weary, here is rest. Mm-hmm. Now, I also want the Christian community to be a community that is offering a model of life to the world that can be found no place else. And that actually means, like, we need to do stuff, right? And yes, I think it's right that we study the Bible outside of church on Sunday morning, right? And that we engage in service to other people. But ultimately, the church can be a community of consolation, to be a community of rest. And I think in beginning in that place, saying, you are enough, Jesus has done enough, then we can begin to form communities that are communities of resistance that offer to the world a kind of model of life, of wholeness of life, of abundant life that they can't find any place else.
You make this very interesting connection to being satisfied and to a satisfaction theory of the atonement. It made me think of Julie of Norwich and one of her visions of Jesus on the cross. He says to her, are you satisfied? Are you satisfied with this sacrifice? He uses the word satisfaction. Could you say more about that?
So there's a number of different threads there. One
yes,
is
can
I
you
pick
please
up,
fully answer
yes,
all of them
all of
in
them.
two minutes.
So there's the phrase that comes to us from the Anglican prayer book tradition, that Jesus was the full, perfect, and sufficient sacrifice, oblation, and satisfaction. Now, I don't dive quite as deeply into the theology of the atonement here as perhaps some people would have wanted me to. But I simply, by drawing on that word satisfaction, I think I want to say that the principles of Jesus are principles of enoughness. And this connects back to something I said earlier in the book. You know, when we talk about the economy, I talk about the economy sometimes as the just do it economy, using the phrase from the Nike advertising campaign, right? That we live in an economy where we are judged by our performance, by our ability, by our accomplishments. Just do it. It's a very seductive phrase. And I think that the Christian gospel says something entirely different. It's not about what you do. It's about what Jesus has done in his life, death, and resurrection. Jesus has done enough. And therefore, you don't need to do anything to be right in the world. Jesus says, are you satisfied in that vision? I think that's what all of us are looking for. All of us are looking for some sort of sense of enoughness and contentment. And it's staring at us right there on the cross and in the empty tomb. And none of us need to do anything else to be made right in the world. And that's, in this day and age, a message that is so counter to what the powers and the principalities of our time would have to say.
Gosh, and I wonder if each of us listening today would just take a moment and imagine that Christ asked us that question, what we would say. And it just occurs to me that I would probably say, Lord, I'm sorry. No, I'm not. You know, thank you for everything. However, I got a whole honeydew list for you. Let me start with, you know, it's like rolling down across the floor. So yeah. Yeah. And in fact, he says to Julian, if I could do more, I would, which says so much. I think we've got time for one more question here. Going back to the poly crisis, the way that these things that are afflicting us that we're part of are all linked together, the market, communications, the way we travel, the way that we produce and have food and clothing, the way that we make war. These are all things that the ways we do them have been globalized to some extent or another and powerfully shape, as we've talked about, the structures in which we're able or not to preach the good news of Jesus with a fulsome witness. And I think this is where your ecumenical interests come in some, Jesse. Can you help us understand how is being globalized not the same thing as what the church is, which is Catholic? How is Catholicity different from globalization? And how might we see this difference concretely, like in a local church or in a Christian household?
So the word Catholic is often translated as universal, but it really means something more like in respect of the whole. So thinking about wholeness or completeness, which are words I've already used here today, globalization, I think, has some interesting parallels and some important differences between Catholics. So as I understand globalization, what it does is it brings together universalizing norms with a local particularity. So you and I had to email to set this up. There's universalizing norms of email standards and routers and things I don't understand, such that, you know, you in the United States and me in Canada and wherever you are in the world, we can communicate with each other, right? We see that in lots of other ways. So free trade agreements, right? Free trade agreements, the hallmark of the era of globalization, saying, you know, we have universalizing standards for what these goods should look like and where tariffs should be. And we're going to impose those around the world. And basically, a universalizing norm and a local particularity come in contact with each other. I think the Christian gospel is actually somewhat similar, right? Because we have a universalizing message. The good news of Jesus is for all people. And yet, Jesus was incarnate in a particular place at a particular time. And the Christian gospel is present in countless local particularities around the world. And part of the history of Christian mission and Christian appropriation has been wrestling with the universalizing message of Jesus and its local particularities. So where they're different is in the answer that they give. So in globalization, the answer that globalization gives is basically have the universal steamroll the local. And part of the frustration and the backlash against globalization that we've been seeing in recent years has been local particularities saying, wait, hold on just a second. We don't like this in the way that, you know, you think it should be done. And it's likely that we're in a time of economic globalization being in retreat. And we see that with free trade agreements, you know, not being as prominent and tariffs, et cetera.
And I think to some extent, we see that in nationalism as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. For 100% reluctance to embrace immigration comes from many places, but certainly it comes from that as well. The answer that the church gives at its best is a little bit different. It's to say, we embrace all of it. We embrace the local particularity and the universalizing norm. So if globalization is about homogenization, trying to make us all consumers of the same Coca-Cola wherever we are in the world, the Catholic Church says, no, we want to embrace all of this diversity, all this heterogeneity, and bring it all together before God. Now, that's what the church does at its best. There's lots of examples of the church not being at its best, where the church has tried to insist on homogenization to get rid of diversity. But we know that God creates this diversity and that God wants to bring all of it into community before God. So Catholicity is much more messy. It's not tidy, but I think it's what the gospel calls us to, because it's at the very heart of the gospel message that all of us in this body are brought before Christ. You know, as for what this looks like in my current context in Montreal, as is true in many other places, you know, our churches are being reshaped by waves of immigration. And I have so loved to see how Christian communities at their best have welcomed people from around the world, people who speak different languages, people who have different immigration statuses, people who come from different cultures and think about Jesus in different ways. I've seen some really positive ways in which these communities are being created. You know, just one story that summarizes it. It's perhaps a trivial story, but at the Christmas Day service at the church that I attend last year, we have a young woman at this church who's originally from India, and her mother was actually in town visiting. And they turned up to church on Christmas Day dressed in these beautiful saris, as you'd expect, just absolutely wonderful. And because we had a white Christmas, they showed up as well in these big winter boots. And I sort of teased them. I was like, well, how often do you, wear like these big, winter boots with your sari? Oh, never worn it before. And then I had this image, they were talking to these children, who may or may not have been my own children, who, because it was Christmas Day, had decided the right thing to wear to church that day was their Christmas pajamas, which were like these one-piece elf costume sort of pajamas. And then the priest showed up with his chasuble on. And I had this wonderful image of the body of Christ, of these children dressed in elf costumes, these people from India wearing saris and winter boots, and the priest in the chasuble, all talking together. And I thought, this is just one instance, but this is what a Catholic church looks like here in Montreal. And my goodness, this is the kind of church I want to be a part of.
Wow. I mean, where else, Jesse, does a person go to see something like that?
Precisely. That is exactly it. Where else in society would you have people from India and, children in elf costumes talking to each other? You know, the intergenerational conversation, the cross-cultural conversation, the real just desire for relatedness and mutuality. That's what I find in the church, and I don't find it in other places.
It's beautiful that things like this are the kinds of things in your book that you want to point to and draw out as acts of resistance. That sometimes resistance is a protest, it's a letter to your senator, it's a boycott, it's, all kinds of things that are more, for lack of a better word, I suppose, aggressive or in your face. And other times it's the kind of cultivation of environments that are just different from what we could create on our own and from our own kind of worldly vision of how things should be and how we should relate to one another, and just the faithfulness of God to set us right and the beauty that is possible through that. So I love the kinds of examples you give like this of acts and visions of resistance.
And I really want to underscore that point, because resistance is a communal endeavor. It's not something that any of us can do by ourselves. And ultimately, the resistance that we're seeking to offer to the powers and the principalities is the kind of life that we as the Christian community offer. And look, I can tell that story. I can tell lots of other stories in which I'm not finding that quality of life in the church. And I'm sure that you can too, right? We fail as a church all the time. But that doesn't mean that it's not the right path to go down. What we are looking for is forming a community that is living by a set of values, that's living by the good news, and precisely by doing that is offering resistance to the powers of this world. And yes, that resistance is going to look like us doing stuff in the world. It's going to look like us protesting and being engaged politically in a variety of ways. But ultimately, it has its roots in the sacramental, in the scriptural, in the shared life that we as Christians have. And that life is a faithful life, it's a creative life, and ultimately, I think it's a hope-filled life. And that's what I'm trying to offer to the church in this moment of polycrisis.
And its goal is rest and contentment, which is something that I can definitely get behind. I've been speaking today with the Reverend Dr. Jesse Zink, principal of Montreal Diocesan Theological College and canon theologian in the Diocese of Montreal. He's also author of the book we've been discussing today, Faithful, Creative, Hopeful, 15 Theses for Christians in a Crisis-Shaped World. Jesse, thanks so much for coming on the show today. I had a lovely time talking with you.
Thanks so much, and thanks for all the work you do with this podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Living Church Podcast, a ministry of the Living Church. If you're interested in Jesse's work or his downloadable discussion guide for Faithful, Hopeful, Creative, you can find links to those in the show notes today. In 2 weeks, be right back here. We're going to be talking with the director of the Wendell Berry Center, Mary Berry, about faith and farming, forming healthy communities, and what it's like to have Wendell Berry as a dad. Until then, our producer is Leslie Thompson. I'm Amber Noel, your host, and it's been good to be with you. Peace.